Are you ready for the most ridiculous internet sports show you have ever seen? Welcome to React, home of the most outrageous and hilarious videos the web has to offer. So join me, Rocky Theus, and my co-host, Raiders Pro Bowl defensive end, Max Crosby, as we invite your favorite athletes, celebrities, influencers, entertainers in for an episode of games, laughs, and of course, the funniest reactions to the wildest web clips out there. Catch React on YouTube, and that is React, R-E-A-X-X. Don't miss it.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Regressing to the mean since 2015, it's the Hockey PDO Cast with your host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockey PDO Cast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy Craig Hustins. Craig, what's going on, man?
What's up, Dmitry? How are you?
I'm good. Do you so you have your own podcast now? You have the Full 60.
Yeah.
Do you have a go-to catchphrase yet that you start off the show with?
Yeah. I always start every show off with, "All right, everybody, let's play a full 60 out there," and we just kind of go from there.
You know, it'd be a good gimmick. I mean, it is the full 60. If you just cut off your conversation exactly the 60-minute mark, even if you were like having a fascinating back and forth with someone.
Sorry, it's only 60 minutes.
Yeah, sorry.
I did find myself wondering if I thought we were going to go under on my last episode, which ended up being a lot of fun. It was a Thrashers retrospective with Ray Ferraro and the first ever Thrashers beat writer, Jeff Schultz. And it ended up being like 59 minutes. So I went a little long in my outro because I had people commenting on the first one. Hey, it was an hour and 3 minutes. That's 3 minutes over 60.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a name. I don't think I have to be beholden to times, do I?
No, there's some real sticklers out there for that stuff.
Like, do you mention PDO in every one of your podcasts?
No, I don't. I definitely don't.
But I got it in there just in case for you.
Yeah, we got it this time with full quota. No, I don't. I think, listen, like, I remember when I started doing this thing, the shows were pretty short. They were like 30 to 35, maybe 40 minutes. And I was trying to bang them out. And it was more stressful now as I've done more of them and gotten more reps under my belt. I feel much more comfortable just sort of taking it slow and going topic by topic. And now I've been stretching it out to like over an hour pretty much every time. And I remember during the summer I had one that was like an hour and a half, and I actually had some guy like freak out at me being like, "That's way too long." And it's like, it's a podcast. You don't have to listen to it in one sitting. Like, you can break it down into different sections,
or you don't have to listen to the whole thing. It's like, true. If you only have 30 minutes, go ahead and cut it off.
But well, how do you know what the best 30 minutes are?
That's a great point. See, it's on you to edit it down. I agree with that guy now. You've convinced me.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll talk more about your podcast later, but first let's talk about your book.
Yes.
The Bench. So last time I had you on when we did the watchability rankings, I think 2 weeks ago, I was telling you how I had just started and I'd maybe gotten about a third of the way through or halfway through. Now I've officially finished, so I can I'm free to talk about the full book in its entirety from start to finish.
All right. What's your you just finished it. Mm-hmm. This is fun to get feedback as a writer. What's your initial thoughts? Be honest. Like, we're all friends here.
I loved it. I mean, obviously the idea itself is a great one, and reading it, I was surprised that I hadn't really read more stuff like this, like picking people's brains. Obviously, I guess you gotta sort of, it's a two way street. You gotta get their time and commitment to it as well. And I thought you executed it really well. I mean, obviously, like, you know what my main criticism is going to be. It's I would have liked to see you kind of poke and prod a bit more in the Tortorella and Ron Wilson chapters and stuff like that. And I'm sure that in your time hanging out with those guys, you had discussions with them, and just for the sake of not doing a 700, 800 page book, you had to kind of cut down and put the most interesting stuff in there. But yeah. I would love to just, I don't know, that stuff was fascinating when you were talking to Mike Sullivan and John Tortorella about sort of, you know, after they got fired from the Canucks, like what they did in their path to getting back to the NHL and how they took that time off to actually do a bit of research and learn some stuff that they hadn't really had time to do while they were NHL coaches. So stuff mm-hmm. like that fascinated me. But I mean, listen, I'm not buttering you up here because you're my guest, but I thoroughly enjoyed it and recommend everyone reads it.
So, okay, the concept, just so if listeners aren't familiar with it, I sat down with 10 coaches. We watched game film together at like their home or office or summer home or whatever it would have been. And kind of, I really just let the conversation go wherever they wanted. So some coaches it was, you know, there was some X's and O's or it was about the game. Other coaches it wasn't about the game at all. Like you mentioned Tortorella, I think that because the game was so long ago, the Lightning winning the Stanley Cup, beating the Calgary Flames, that we ended up, and so much has happened to him since it ended up becoming this conversation about his path. So, but I'm curious by your thoughts, and we can, you wanted me to prod. Let's start with Ron Wilson.
Okay.
Ron Wilson, we watched, I went back to back chapters with him and Mike Babcock with the same game, the 2010 Olympic Canadian gold medal game or U.S. silver medal game, however you want to phrase it. Let me just preemptively defend myself on Ron Wilson, because it was the first time either of us had watched, and this was a fit my failure as a writer. It was the first time either of us had ever watched this game. And I think this was the second coach I did. So I was still kind of figuring out how to do this. And as you guys all know, like that game is one of the best. I mean, that's one of the best, maybe it's the best game I've ever been to live. Mm-hmm. Like great game, great action. So there was long stretches where we're just watching and into it, because he hasn't watched it since he lost. I haven't watched it since I covered it. So it had been 6 or 7 years. And then I realized, the first period, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is going to make a horrible book if we're just going to sit here in silence and watch games and go, ooh, great play. So then the conversation started. But it was hard because he'd get rolling and then something would happen and it would take us back. So where did you want me to push more with Ron?
I thought the stuff about him and Phil Kessel was interesting. And obviously that's something people will kind of circle back to. And it's a bit of a pressure point. And I don't know. I found the kind of dichotomy, I guess, between his feelings on Phil Kessel and then the stuff Mike Sullivan was saying about him and Mike Sullivan's chapter fascinating. And sort of, that's the thing I took away from the Mike Sullivan chapter. I think you were trying to make that point as well about how, he can adapt very well and he sort of, puts his players in a better position to succeed. And it's not like the thing that always fascinates me about coaching is how much of it is, you know, a guy who's has his own systems and the way he wants his teams to play and he's set in that way versus a coach that comes into a new situation and sort of adjusts around the players that are already in place. And, you know, when Mike Sullivan came in and took over that Penguins team, he obviously sort of recognized that they needed to be playing a certain different way than they were playing under Mike Johnston, where they just needed to play faster and get the puck up the ice as quickly as they could. And that really benefited the personnel they had there. And maybe that's just the thing that he would have done anyways, but you know, it's quite possible that if he was in a different situation with a different team, maybe he would have approached it a different way. So I'm always kind of curious to see how adaptable coaches are, because that's ultimately what's going to determine success in the league, but also provide them with longevity, because you're not always going to have the same group of players.
Right, for sure. I just had this conversation briefly. I'm doing a story on Claire Drake, who's going into the Hall of Fame, I think as a builder. He's a kind of a legendary coach in the coaching circles, and Barry Trotz, you know, is kind of one of his disciples, and Barry was saying the same thing. He's like, it's funny when you play teams around the league, you can tell, there's some guys like you can tell it's not, either it's Mike Babcock or it's a Mike Babcock disciple. Like he says, you know, you play Carolina and it's a mirror image of Toronto. I mean, they're doing what they're doing. And then you have some coaches that it's very personnel based. And I think one of the things that Mike Sullivan was interesting to me about when I sat down with him and John Tortorella were at the same time, so they're both in the room as we're watching these games, is that he got Sidney Crosby involved kind of right off the hop and said, okay, how do you want to play? How can we maximize? Because if like people forget when Mike Sullivan joined the Penguins, like people were talking about how Sidney Crosby was no longer one of the best players in the game. I had a conversation with a general manager in a press box and we were talking about Sid and I said, you know, is he even top five right now to you? And he said, no. So like, which is, yeah. And it was, and at the time I'm like, yeah, that's probably fair. Cause he wasn't himself. And Mike Sullivan, to his credit, I mean, and Mike Babcock brought this up when he talked about Sidney Crosby and the lines he played on the Olympics. When you put it on the player, when you give them the opportunity to have input, it also, you're putting it on their shoulders to produce on some level too.
Right.
They now have some skin in the game. It's their kind of concept. It's how they want to play. And maybe that is how Mike Sullivan wanted to play all along, but I think he was smart to get Sid on board right away.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go chapter by chapter here. I have a few notes on each coach that I think sort of have a practical discussion that we can get deeper into. I mean, the Dan Bylsma chapter you started off with, you know, the thing that I took away from that was he was so vividly talking about, you know, when they get that lead in game seven against the Red Wings and they go up 2-0, how the Penguins as a team sort of adjusted the way they were playing, where, you know, obviously when you're protecting a lead late in a playoff game like that, you're taking shorter shifts, you're focusing on the hockey cliches of getting the puck deep,
right,
and playing it safe and all that. And obviously, you know, it's human nature and no one wants to be the guy that's going to make the mistake and be the GOAT. But I'm always fascinated by how, you know, like the concept of score effects and how we know that when teams go up, they start playing much differently than they would otherwise. Very conservatively, they get into a defensive shell and the other team starts outshooting and outchancing them much greater than they would have otherwise. And that's sort of, there's that interplay between the, you know, human psychology where it's going to happen anyways, just because you want to hold on to that lead while you have it, versus sort of acknowledging that, well, if you go up early in a game, maybe the best way to defend that lead is to actually just keep attacking and keep playing your game. Cause we've seen so many times that once you change that, maybe they can, things can go southward really quickly for you. So
yeah,
I don't know, like stuff like that is while I was reading the Bylsma chapter, that's what really stuck out to me.
It was interesting. Cause I think I ended up cutting it out. Cause there's a point in the game. Cause when my first crack at this was, I think 100,000 words or 110,000 words. And then I went back and looked at my contract and it was for like 80 or 70. Like I was way over.
Right.
So there was a lot of chopping and for good measure, like a lot of stuff didn't need to be in there. It was self-indulgent. But for Dan Bylsma, there was a point where I think it was a 2-on-1 or something, like the Penguins, you know, they're protecting this lead and they dumped it in. It didn't like change or whatever. And Dan just started, he's like, look, you know, as coaches, yes, we want them to play a little more conservative when you have a lead, but I'm never telling guys dump a puck in when you have an odd man rush. Yeah. He's just like, but these, it's just like you said, it becomes human nature to these guys. And he's like, and it wasn't like we weren't reminding him to do this. We weren't saying short shifts. They just go into that mode trying to protect the lead. What jumped out to me with Dan Bylsma, and this became a bit of a theme throughout, even in the Joel Quenneville, and we can get to that in a sec, is how tenuous that team's place was in kind of, and Dan Bylsma in hockey history. Like there's a point where late in the game where the Red Wings, I think it hits, there's a shot from the point or whatever, and it hits the crossbar.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there with Dan Bylsma and he just kind of lets out a low whistle and he's like, whew, man, that shot goes, we're talking about an inch. That shot goes in, the Red Wings win in overtime. Maybe Dan, you know, now maybe Sidney Crosby's, the pressure on him to win a cup is higher. And imagine if they don't win that cup and it all go, you know, then what follows had followed. And, you know, Sidney Crosby doesn't have a cup early on in his career. And maybe he doesn't know how to win the big game. And Dan Bylsma, like all of these different narratives because a puck was an inch off. And you know, a coach after coach in this process said, man, people don't want to talk about how much luck is involved in this, but it's a big part of the equation in these moments.
Yeah. Yeah. To win it, you know, to win it all, you really need a lot of things to go your way. I mean, the other thing that I took away was, and you made this point in there as well, as, you know, if you told someone after that season when the Penguins did win that cup, that it would take them so long to get back to that level, they probably wouldn't believe you just because they had that. You know, you knew that some of those supporting roles were going to change and they'd have to bring in different guys there. But ultimately with Crosby and Malkin, you figure that it wouldn't take that long, but it did. And it just, that's like the point I always try to make it, you know, you definitely don't always just want to kind of go all in and just neglect the future entirely and just trade all your picks for current win now guys and then see where it goes after, because that can obviously go horribly wrong too. But when you're a team that has a chance to win it, there is something to be said for making a more sort of concerted, aggressive effort to do so, because you can't just take for granted that it's going to happen again to you.
Right. And I remember, so there was a point, so they did push in a lot. Like Ray Shero was aggressive at the deadline year after year with the Penguins. And then when Jim Rutherford took over, I remember not liking the Phil Kessel trade and saying, you know, maybe let's take a couple years and reset and gather some young players and young assets rather than continuing what they'd been doing. And obviously I was wrong. It all worked out great and they've got multiple cups. Right. But I think you're right in that, especially if you can win one early, like the Penguins did and like the Blackhawks did. I just think that it takes pressure off you down the road. It you have that experience now. It sets you up. So I would tend to be aggressive. Like I look at where a couple teams are in their life cycle. Like I wrote this last year about the Leafs. Mm-hmm. I would have even maybe taken a run at Shattenkirk. Like, you know, make that play early without assuming that you're going to have a decade of glory.
Yeah, yeah. Same thing with the Oilers. I think that was the disappointment where while they had Dreisaitl and they still have McDavid this year for way cheaper than he's going to be moving forward, that they didn't kind of optimize that and try to win now as opposed to taking it slow. The other thing I took away was, like, I liked some chapters in here because they were just reminders and kind of walks down memory lane and stuff that you forget about a little bit. And I think, I wonder if we truly appreciate Evgeny Malkin and his individual greatness, because, you know, he's obviously got a bunch of accolades, and when you watch him at the top of his game, it's impossible not to marvel at what he's capable of. But just kind of thinking back to this year he had, where he was really the Penguins' driving force. I mean, you look at his numbers that season, and it was like 113 points in the regular season, and then he had 36 and 24 in the postseason. And there was that 2-year window there before he had some injuries and he started missing some games, where he was like his peak performance was arguably as high as, and if not higher than, you know, what Crosby and Ovechkin and the other greats from his generation get credit for. And he never really gets lumped in that discussion, and I think he ultimately should. And I wonder how history is going to remember him by the time he finishes his career.
I think we're going to see, there's going to be kind of a Evgeny Malkin rally at the end of his career, because I he's so good, and I think on some level he's taken for granted, and on some level he, you know, there's the shared spotlight with Sidney Crosby. But I look at what's happened to Joe Thornton kind of in the twilight of his career. Like, people appreciate him now. They appreciate his greatness. He went from a guy where people criticized him and ripped him and he was a choke artist and all this stuff and underachiever. And I think history has a way of kind of self-correcting, and my sense is I think history is going to be really good to Evgeny Malkin.
I hope so. It's tough to say. Like, on the one hand, he's talented enough where there's no reason not to believe that he couldn't be able to, if he had been in a different situation, carry his own team. But then obviously, like, so he loses some of that limelight and the spotlight with Crosby being there as well and being a bigger star, especially in Canada. But at the same time, like, you wonder if he'd gone to a different team and he was the only guy, whether he would have been able to be this successful, or just how different his career would be, because so much of it is situation-based, right? Like, the guy's not going to have the same career if he goes in two different teams with two different supporting casts. So it's kind of, I'm always interested in thinking about that in this, like, parallel universe. If he had been drafted to a different team without a superstar already in place, how he would have looked.
When he was being rumored to be traded to the Kings, was that like, was Kopitar coming back? Like, I would like to know if we're doing like a parallel universe, what life would have looked like for the Kings if, wasn't that the big rumor one year, like a long time ago?
Yeah. Well, here's a parallel universe. What would Jonathan Toews' career have looked like if he was drafted instead of Jordan Staal?
Oh, man. Can you imagine?
But that's the thing. Like, would he, do you think a guy like Jonathan Toews would, be considered this like consummate leader and cornerstone of a franchise if he came into a group that already sort of had those guys in place?
Yeah, like would he have been allowed to grow into that role?
Right.
If yeah, I mean the only comparison I can make is would be on like on Hockey Canada, right? When Team Canada plays in the Olympics, and like those aren't Jonathan Taves' like teams, are they? Like he plays, I don't want to say a complimentary role because he's a big part of that team, but
right.
He plays more of a shutdown. I mean, I guess he does have Chicago. I don't know. That's a great question. Would Jonathan Taves be Jonathan Taves in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a case to be made that the personality would just be so overwhelming that maybe it would win out anyways, even if he's not the most talented guy. But it's
would he still be there? Like they wouldn't even be able to afford all three.
No. Yeah, someone probably would have been gone.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Let's. Is there anything else on any other anecdotes that you couldn't put into the book or that you wanted to talk about Bosma?
With Dan? No. I think is one of the longer chapters. So I got a lot. I really like him. He's an interesting guy. It was an interesting kind of point in history for the kind of the great team of this era. So I had fun diving in there. So no, I think we're good there.
All right. Ron Wilson. So we already kind of touched a little bit about you hanging out with him and watching that Olympic game and his relationship with Phil Kessel. What else is there on Ron that we should talk about?
Well, the only thing I would say on that one, I did talk to Phil and you know, just kind of, you do this as a writer, you just say, hey, do you have anything to add or your side? And Phil doesn't care, right? And he's like, no, I've got nothing to say here. I think essentially with Ron Wilson, it was interesting to see kind of the two sides of it, where he basically was like, he struggled to find a way to use Phil effectively on a winning team, whereas Mike Sullivan obviously successfully did, but not without hiccups. Like there's a point in the Mike Sullivan chapter where he talks about approaching Phil to play on that the HBK line before Malkin got hurt, and Phil just was like, not into it at all. So it's not like it's smooth sailing, you know, once he gets to Pittsburgh, to be fair to Ron, but like, yeah, Ron was great. And it was another example of, it was actually the flip side of the example of what if a puck bounces a different way? And what if the Americans score in overtime, and how differently are we looking at Mike Babcock versus Ron Wilson? And you know, the Parise Suter American generation versus the unbeatable Canadians, that to me it was the other side of the coin, where all these narratives are created because of a one goal loss.
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk about the Mike Babcock chapter, because I thought this was the most, I mean, the Sullivan Tortorella chapter was obviously great, and we'll get to that in a second, but the Mike Babcock chapter, like, I know this is a hockey book, but you could have easily just taken that and put in some sort of like a motivational, like life guidance book, because I thought like the stuff he was talking about in terms of change agents and sort of, you know, being proactive rather than reactive and in embracing change and doing and kind of getting ahead of stuff as opposed to waiting for things to go bad and then making moves is like very inspirational, motivational stuff that I think we can apply to our day-to-day life. So I actually really enjoyed that chapter the most, I think.
It's the best chapter to me for that reason, because it kind of transcends the sport. It's applicable to people's, like, I think if people just bought the book and read that chapter, it would be worth it, you know, and I loved all of them, to me, he was so good on that topic, and it was, and you see him kind of talk about these things, and it's picked up, but it was an opportunity really to sink our teeth into it. And when he says, you know, hey, I look outside of the sport of hockey for inspiration, I look outside of the sport of hockey to find new things I can then import to the Toronto Maple Leafs. And then to be able to talk to some of those people, you know, a CEO of a company in California who met Mike Babcock while hunting sheep, you know, to have his perspective in there and say, you know, this is what I watched Mike Babcock apply after talking about how I run my company. It was just, it was transformative for me as a person, just to go through this process of talking to Mike, talking to the people he's impacted. And then you sit there and you can't help but kind of self-reflect, right? Like it was an important chapter in this book.
Well, there's also this one passage you had in there which really stuck out to me, and it's sort of, I think it's something we keep circling back to, a lot of the issues that plague the NHL and some of the frustrations people like myself and a lot of others out there have with the league is the fact that it doesn't really, it's not conducive to embracing change. And it's really kind of stuck in its ways. And it's a lot of the logic is, well, we've always done it this way, which is obviously horribly flawed for a lot of reasons. And then there's also, you can kind of spin in the direction of, it is also a bit of a copycat league too. So as soon as someone kind of makes that first uncomfortable step and shows that something can be done, all of a sudden everyone flocks to it. And right. I'm fascinated by that. And obviously that sort of leaves a lot of room for progressive, creative individuals to make their mark in the league still, because if they're willing to put themselves on the line and sort of try some new stuff, there's going to be this window where they're going to be doing it while others are still skeptical, and that gives them a massive competitive advantage. So I guess there's that angle to it too.
Yeah. I got on my soapbox a little bit in that chapter for that. Like, it's one of my frustrations with the NHL is that not only is it, like, people that try to do things differently, they take a risk. There's also like the kind of the old school hockey world tends to like close ranks and go on the attack if the first sign is not working out. And we've seen it, like, for example, we saw it in Florida. Yep. Like, you know, the computer guys or whatever we want to say there, you know, I don't care what your philosophy is, you can't build a team in a year. You know what I mean? Like, I don't care if you're doing it old school, new school, whatever it is, you can't. That's not enough time to evaluate whether or not something works. And then that became a punchline when they kind of were in and out in a very short order. I'm sure if the Arizona Coyotes continue to struggle this season, people will start saying, look at John Chyka. You know, here's a guy that's constantly looking for something new, trying to find an edge with a small budget team, you know, big into analytics, has a lot of people on his staff looking at that. And I'm telling you, knowing this world, if, you know, there's going to be people kind of making smart comments and running him down. And because it's like everyone just kind of is protecting their own turf and they don't want to change and they want to own their little tiny kingdoms, not tiny, but in some cases. But and it's one of my frustrations with the league, like every other. I mean, I guess this happens in baseball on some level, but it just seems like every other league is so open to trying new ideas and hockey tends to fight it. Yeah. And that's why I admire Mike Babcock, because, you know, he's a guy that now has accomplished enough. He's got the clout that he can do it. Right. And nobody's going to say anything, 'cause it's Mike Babcock. And you look at one of the things I think Toronto does really well is they've built out a front office and a coaching staff with a wide variety of voices. So it's not a bunch of people that echo Mike Babcock's beliefs or Lou Lamoriello's beliefs. And in a cap system, that's one way to take advantage of being a big market team. And why other teams don't do that have money to spend, I have no idea.
Well, I can, I have a good idea for why that is the case. I mean, obviously, if you reach a certain level, of stature and power in your career, I'm sure that, you kind of trick yourself into believing that you have all the answers at that point and you're smarter than everyone, and then you don't really want dissenting opinions in the room because it's going to make you kind of question stuff and maybe look potentially bad, and it just seems like an unnecessary hassle. So why wouldn't you rather just support yourself with sort of not necessarily yes men, but people that think along the same lines as you, because it's going to support your own beliefs and not kind of take you outside the box,
I guess. But good luck with that, because that ends up in disaster typically.
Yeah, but it goes back to the point of sort of comfort zones, right? And that was the whole thing about taking yourself out of the comfort zone. And I also love the idea of hockey fans also have this a bit of a complex where as soon as you start talking about a different sport, they get like very protective. And there is a whole lot of like that hashtag, please like my sport element
to
it.
For sure.
As an analyst and someone who thinks about the game a lot, I love looking at other, I love watching other sports first and foremost. I'm not necessarily just only looking at hockey, but also in terms of kind of gleaning potentially interesting concepts and applying them to hockey. Obviously, there's going to be, you know, different stuff going on in different sports, but there are sort of philosophies maybe or things that you can kind of look at and go, that's interesting. I never really thought about that before. How would that look in hockey? And all of a sudden, just asking those questions all of a sudden gets you on the right path, I feel like.
For sure. And so that's what Mike Babcock's great at. And he's not just looking outside of hockey and sports. He's looking in business. He's looking anywhere. Like that really struck me. And I, you know, and if you read the chapter, you pick up on it. Like he's just constantly like trying to learn something new. Like there's no just conversation with him. And hey, you know, here's a book I read. Then he's pulling out, he's taking notes constantly, watching this game. You know, here it's a nice summer day. We're watching his Olympic gold medal win. This could have been, hey, let's kick back and have a beer and watch this and relive the glory days. And Mike is at the edge of his seat, leaning forward with a pen and a paper, and he's taking notes because he wants to apply something he's in this moment that he can then use with Team Canada in the World Cup, which was going to happen a month later. So he was looking for clips in this game. You know, that's how his mind works. And I think there's a lot anyone can learn from that.
I love it. Craig, let's take a quick break here to hear from a sponsor, and we'll pick up the rest of the book on the other side of things.
Cool.
Before we get back to deep diving Craig Custance' fantastic new book, let's take a little bit of time to talk about SeatGeek, the longtime sponsor of the Hockey PDOcast. Anyone out there that's gone through the process of trying to find tickets to a sporting event or a concert in the past knows full well that it can be a bit of a pain in the ass. You're bouncing around from one site to the other, the prices are changing, you can't make sense of why certain tickets cost what they do when others are different. None of it makes sense, and that's where SeatGeek comes into play. Their goal is to save you your invaluable time and your hard-earned money by making getting your hands on those tickets easier and more reliable than ever before. With their seamless mobile app, all it takes is just a couple taps and you're there. And you can rest assured knowing that what you're paying for is what you're getting, fully guaranteed. Regardless of what you're going to see, you ultimately really can't put a price on how rewarding it is just not having to deal with NHL TV and all the accompanying shenanigans that come with it. I have to put up with it because I'm bouncing around from game to game on a nightly basis trying to keep up with everything. But it's honestly gotten to the point where there's nothing more stressful in my life than when the game goes to commercial and I get stuck in one of those never-ending loops of generic commercials that they have playing for the thousandth time. Don't live in fear like I do. Don't subject yourself to that type of punishment. And best of all, my listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. All you got to do is download the SeatGeek app, enter the promo code PDO, and you're good to go. That's promo code PDO for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. And while you're enjoying yourself at the game, remember the Hockey PDO cast. Feel free to shoot me a quick line on Twitter and you know, take a picture, show me you're having a good time. I love living vicariously through my listeners. And with that, let's get back to Custance's book called The Behind the Bench. All right. So I think the next chapter chronologically is the Bob Hartley chapter. Bob
Uncle
Hartley,
Bob,
as some people would call him. What were your main takeaways from hanging out with him? Because and some of this comes across in your words, but there is this sort of commonly held belief that he's a bit of a, you know, old school kind of hard ass,
which he disagrees with, which we get into in this chapter. Right. I don't think any coach likes to hear that. You know, Bob, when I asked that, I asked that of him, you know, he went into examples of where he's helped players in kind of in their personal lives and in hockey. But basically he's like, if you don't want to work, then we're not going to get along, you know? Right. And so, but of course we've all heard that about Bob Hartley, like you know, he's one of those shelf life coaches and all of that. But in terms of what I admire about Bob Hartley and telling his story is he's a guy that went about it in a way where he had to earn everything he got, right? Like some coaches are former players. And so the second they're done playing, they have a spot as an assistant coach on their former teammates' AHL team or whatever it looks like, right? Like they have a clear path and name recognition. And then their old GM is going to bring them up to the, you know, there's these, all these connections. Mm-hmm. Bob Hartley's a guy that was working in a windshield factory. Like there was, right. He has, you know, wasn't a former player, you know, played more baseball than he did hockey. And so he had to be completely self-made and without any connections. And I think it's, and he did, like, you just look, so he wins at that level, moves up a level, wins a championship at the next level, moves up a level, wins a championship. Clearly the guy can coach. Like, you don't just have success after success after success. I watch him navigate in Atlanta and get a team into the playoffs that had, you know, he got a Thrashers team in the playoffs that no one ever else in that franchise history was able to do. Mm-hmm. Like, he can coach. And then, but I also think that, you know, the hockey world is one, and I wrote this, like, there's cliques. So you have your Hockey Canada guys, you have your USA hockey guys, you have your Western Canadian guys, you have your Ontario guys. And Bob Hartley is, you know, a French-speaking coach from Ontario, you know, like,
right.
Doesn't fit any of those. And I think it's hurt his ability to kind of get back into the game at times. And now, you know, I'll be interested to see, like, I'm sure he would still want to coach and you know, who knows if he's going to get that opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the interesting thing about Hartley, when he was coaching the Flames, they had that that one surprise season where they made the playoffs and they beat the Canucks in the first round. And, you know, everyone was writing all these stories about the job he'd done with that young Flames team and how he'd gotten through to some of their younger stars and how they were headed on the right path. And he was, you know, given a lot of credit for it, and I'm sure deservedly so. But then the Flames front office went out and gave him this massive extension while he still had years on his contract. And then obviously they didn't sort of realize that there was also this like luck component to it, where maybe they were playing over their heads and they weren't as good as they were. And all of a sudden they come crashing back down to earth the next year. And I think he's, you know, he's released from his deal. And the reason I bring that up is because when we're talking about coaches, something that I keep coming back to is this idea of shelf life and the sort of longevity that you want to give in some of these contracts. And it seems like whenever guys are extended for too long, it generally doesn't wind up working too well. But then you can also make the argument that you have to give the coach a longer term deal to show the players in the room that he's going to stick around rather mm-hmm. than if he's, you know, if he's on an expiring deal that year, all of a sudden he's a bit of a lame duck where the guys might just stop listening to him.
Definitely a guy like Bob Hartley too, right?
Yes.
Like, he's not a guy you want in the last year of his contract. Mm. He is demanding. So it's interesting. I'm doing the forward on an analytics book, and I don't want to give away too much because I don't know, this isn't my book, but it gets into one of the focuses is the transition game in hockey and, you know, where that's your most, you know, that's where you can, the percentage of scoring is the highest, right? Like,
yeah.
we talk about possession and offensive zone time and Corsi and all these things that are great, you know, getting lots of shots and generating lots of offensive zone time, when the reality is a lot of times those aren't, you know, if you're just cycling in the offensive zone, you're not getting a great, you know, the percentage of scoring in that world isn't high. Whereas if there, you know, a stretch pass in a transition and kind of waiting for your moment, those are high percentages. And it's kind of forced me to rethink, you know, how we evaluate coaches or teams. Cause we just assume, oh, if you have a good Corsi, you're a good coach, you're a good mm-hmm. team. I honestly think, like, I think Bob Hartley, the way he coaches, like, there's a lot of counterattack in his game, the stretch pass, a lot of transition. And so it almost became a punchline. Hey, look at the Calgary Flames. They're winning games, you know, down 3 goals. They come back and win. They've got a 42% Corsi. Like, this is not sustainable. Then it doesn't sustain. And haha, we were right.
Mm.
But I also think maybe, you know, here's a guy that recognized we're going to try for these high percentage plays. And he was successful at times. And maybe it's not sustainable. But, you know, people said the same thing for John Tortorella in Vancouver. And he's found a way to make it work in Columbus. I'm just, especially after reading this book, I'm wondering, you know, and I know there's different ways to win in hockey, and I, it really challenged kind of my thoughts on just assuming guys were good at what they do or teams were good because of their possession numbers.
Right. There's many different ways to approach trying to find that success in the league. I agree with that 100%. Okay, let's Todd McClellan here. Yeah, I feel like you know, your description of everything about him and his sort of your surroundings while you did this chapter with him were like really just mellowed me out so much. Like I was like sitting in a coffee shop and I was like living vicariously through it. I was like, wow, I'm super relaxed right now.
I love Todd McClellan. I think he's a good coach. I'll be the first to admit, like, these are a lot of Stanley Cup winning coaches, Olympic gold medal winning coaches. I was looking for a way to get Todd in this book because I think he's an interesting guy. I think he's kind of represents the next generation of coaches, the kind of the John Coopers that know how to work with young players. And so, you know, when he won that world championships with Sidney Crosby and that put Sid in the triple gold club, that was the opportunity to kind of go over that game. Now, it's not a great game to watch because Canada beats the Russians. I mean, whatever it was, 7-1 or something. So the game itself was a non-factor, but where Todd to me was really interesting was his path, you know, working with a guy like Doug Risebrough in the Minnesota organization. He was kind of one of those first young, hot coaches, you know, coming up through the ranks where everyone knew he was going to be a good coach. And he got some pretty good advice from Doug Risebrough that, like, take your time and learn your profession along the way. Don't rush. Don't take the first promotion look at the situation. Don't just take an NHL job to take an NHL job. And again, like, this is like, these were all, and I didn't want to hit the reader over the head with it, but I'm like, this is all stuff that we can learn from, right? Like, you know, try to learn along the way in every situation. And when you get to a point where you're ready to move up, you know, you are when you have kind of multiple opportunities and you can cherry pick the best one. And maybe that's the best time to do something. And I think Todd McClellan's been really smart about that in his career.
Yeah, it's funny. I read that McClellan chapter and that point stuck out to me about sort of, you know, not getting ahead of yourself and taking your time and mastering one level first before, and then everything, the success will come naturally. And then when I was reading the Hitchcock chapter later, I believe like one of his friends gave him the advice of like constantly just trying to think about what your next step is. And while you're at the WHL going, like thinking about the AHL, and when you're in the AHL, thinking about the NHL. And so,
and I don't think they're like exclusive. Yes. One another. Like, yep. The two pieces of advice there, just to be clear.
Right. But. Yeah. Yeah. Of course. Well, that kind of goes to the point where we're saying, oh, there isn't this like one sort of blueprint or, you know, cut and dried way of approaching it. Like you can kind of juggle all these things at once, but yeah, obviously you wrote this, I think, book before, this happened, so you couldn't have really talked about it with him. But like I'd be fascinated to sit down with Todd McClellan right now, and obviously, I mean, it might be a bit of a sore subject or an uncomfortable topic for him to get into, but just like what was going through his head while he was watching the San Jose Sharks make that run to the Cup final 2 years ago. Mm. After he'd been there for so long and on so many good teams, they just kept falling short, and then his first year at it, you know, they replaced him with Pete DeBoer, obviously, and Pete DeBoer very well might have done certain things to, you know, pull the right strings and make it happen, but a lot of it was probably just sort of, it was kind of their time a little bit. They were due, and they would have eventually made it there if McClellan had stuck around, I feel like. So I'm sure there must have been a bit of bitterness involved in that.
Yeah, I imagine. I'm trying to think if I've ever talked to Todd about that, just what it was like. I guess that's not something you are eager to bring up.
Right. And I'm sure, you know, he'd say all the right things about how he's happy for Pete. And
yeah,
you generally...
And happy, yeah.
The thing that I liked was in the Claude Julien chapter where he was talking about his friendship with Alain Vigneault and how now he feels like there's a bit of a strain there because of what he went through in 2011. And I enjoy that. I mean, obviously, you know, I hope for them to resume their friendship one day. But I like that people...
You enjoy that there's a strain?
What kind of horrible person
are you?
I like the transparency involved there, where so many times when you like, there's this coaching fraternity, and generally you hear, I mean, even with when John Tortorella was talking about Bob Hartley and the incident they had when he was coaching the Canucks versus the Flames in that brawl, you know, he mentions that he doesn't want to be lumped into the same sentence as Bob Hartley, and you know, he's a different type of coach than that. But at the same time, he also makes the point of, you know, talking about how he thinks Bob Hartley's a great coach in his own right and stuff. And there's this coaching fraternity, and you're never really going to hear guys talk poorly about each other or really kind of tell you how they really feel, at least not on the record. I'm sure behind the scenes they would if you're having a beer with them, but I'd be fascinated to see like just what Todd McClellan's real feelings are on the success San Jose had 2 years ago while he was
DeBoer.
Yeah. Yeah. That could have been me.
Right. I've never even like coaches. It's probably like writers on some level, man, do we very rarely run each other down? Cause mm-hmm. it's such a tough, you know, the coaching world is so hard and they're getting it enough from the outside of people slinging arrows that I'm trying to think of instances where people, you know, where it usually is, it's if somebody is like different, right? Maybe they're trying to do, and it's the old world kind of protecting the new world, but man, it, very rarely do you see that. But to get to your point about Todd McClellan and the Sharks, like we talk a lot about shelf life with kind of coaches who are challenging and hard on players. I don't want to say players coach because sometimes that has a negative connotation, but I don't think Todd is super hard on guys like where you would have that shelf life. What I think is interesting is regardless of your coaching style, I do think there's a time to change coaches. Right. And I think we saw that in San Jose where Todd McClellan was probably there a year too long. Maybe he would admit this. In fact, he probably would because him and Doug Wilson basically orchestrated him leaving. Like it wasn't like he still had another year on his contract, if I remember correctly. So like that to me is interesting where, you know, you can have a short shelf life because the guy's super demanding, or sometimes teams kind of max out where they're going to go with a coach after a while.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, even if you're spreading the message in a more sort of charismatic, relatable way and you're not just yelling at guys, like eventually just hearing the same thing over and over again is going to just kind of get dulled a bit, right, and lose its effect a little bit. So it makes sense that you would getting a fresh face and a fresh voice in there would help. Yeah, I mean, other than that, on the McClellan stuff, I mean, I'm always fascinated about how coaches deal with superstars and everything that comes with that, and I guess McClellan's getting a good taste for that right now in Edmonton with Connor McDavid. I mean, obviously, by all accounts, it seems like McDavid's a pretty, at least at this stage of his career, a pretty sort of easygoing, low maintenance superstar. But there's a certain element to the handling of that, and whether you're optimizing him, that it sort of adds it's obviously a great thing, and I think every single coach would love to coach a superstar like that, but it does
right.
put a little bit of an added pressure, I imagine, on sort of every decision you make with that guy all of a sudden is examined under a microscope, whereas no one really cares like how you're using Mark Letestu, for example.
Right. No, it's quite, and I that goes back to the Dan Bylsma chapter because he brings that up with Sidney Crosby. And then later on in the Todd McClellan chapters, Todd talks about talking to Sid at the World Championships about how to approach Connor McDavid, because I'm sure he suspected or knew he was going to get the job at Edmonton. And you know, he did say they had conversations, and one of the Dan Bylsma said exactly that. He's like, here it is years later, we're sitting in his living room watching this game, and I'm like, what's it like to coach Sidney Crosby? And he's like, well, there you go. Like that's what it's like, because you're asking this question. He's like, you know, nobody asked me what it was like to coach Hal Gill, you know? Right. And so like those, your decisions become, everything you do around those players becomes scrutinized.
Yeah. Yeah, well, within reason, obviously. So let's move on to let's do Mike Sullivan and John Tortorella here. This is obviously sort of the meatiest chapter in the book. The thing that I find interesting about the two of them, and it's been a bit of a sort of wake up call, or I've learned a lot from how it's played out, is, you know, you generally kind of lump people together by association, and obviously, it had been so long since Mike Sullivan had been an NHL head coach, and we didn't really have a sample on, you know, for an assistant coach, you might hear stories or stuff like that, or a little anecdotes on the side, but you don't really know sort of what they'd be like if they were the head coach, how their team would play, what systems they would use. So I think everyone sort of naturally assumed that Mike Sullivan would be very similar to Tortorella just because of how closely tied and connected they were. So
right.
when he came into Pittsburgh and just sort of started just dealing with the media on a daily basis, and you'd read these really kind of profound, thought-provoking quotes from him about scoring right. chances and expected goals and all this stuff, and you're like, where did this come from? Like, was this there the entire time? And it really just sort of goes to show you that you kind of not only shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but also kind of take every entity for itself and what it's worth, as opposed to sort of just lumping everything together.
For sure. And so a couple of things jumped out with the Mike Sullivan kind of path. One was that John Tortorella basically had been telling teams for years, even teams he was interviewing for the same job as Mike Sullivan, like, I'm not your guy. This is your guy. Like this, he mentioned, I think it was Atlanta, the Islanders, maybe it was the Kings also when they hired who was the coach before Daryl Sutter? I'm already
Kings?
Yeah.
Was it Terry Murray?
Was it Terry Murray? Maybe that was. So there was openings where John Tortorella was basically telling teams, Mike Sullivan needs to be the guy. I've learned more from him than he's learned from me. But like, I just remember I did it myself. Like you lumped the two of them together. And I think there was some pretty smart self-awareness on Mike Sullivan's part to, after the Vancouver kind of disaster, to say, you know what, it's, and they both talked about this, it's time to separate. And there's a point where John Tortorella jumps in, and that's what made their chapter interesting, because we'd be talking to Mike Sullivan, or I'd be talking to Mike about his path, and then John would just kind of be from the other side of the table. Hey, let me add something here. And this was something he really wanted, a point he wanted to make. He said what Mike Sullivan did after Vancouver was so smart. One, like they kind of divorced themselves of each other. Two, he took a job at basically consulting or whatever it was with the Chicago Blackhawks. So it wasn't behind the bench, but you know, you go to a great organization, you learn from Joel Quenneville, one of the, you know, the best coaches of his era, you win a Stanley Cup. Now Mike Sullivan has a whole new experience, can see how this great team does it. It takes maybe a step back as a professional, but has this great experience. Then he goes and takes an NHL head job. Again, maybe a step back, but now, you know, he has this experience with Chicago. He's now running a bench again. He can kind of get back on the path. And basically John Tortorella's points was, you know, that we want to kind of take these linear paths up our career chain. And sometimes the best thing you can do is to take a step back and kind of realign yourself. And Mike Sullivan did that.
Yeah, no, he definitely did. And obviously he came into a pretty good situation as well in terms of the talent he was taking over, but making all of it work and all of it click is part of the gig as well, and he's done that very well, and it seems like he's set up for a longer shelf life based on that demeanor and just sort of how he approaches the job as well, which is I think just as important.
Yeah, but I don't want to, like, Mike's like, if coaching the Penguins was, you know, easy and you could win Stanley Cups, like there wouldn't have been that huge gap between cups. Yes. Right. Yeah. Like I think that the job that Mike Sullivan did last spring in coaching that Penguins team was as good as any coaching job I've seen. Like, you know, we witnessed that kind of the structural differences they made and the kind of the way they rope-a-doped the Washington Capitals in round two. And like Mike was between games was coaching the heck out of him at practice. And I, like, to me now he's become a top three coach in the league. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, and you know, that's, yes, it's a great team and you need to have great players to win. Like all of these games, we're watching Hall of Famers too. So, you know, you hate to make it all about the coaches, but it's not, you know, if it was only about having those great players, they'd have 10 cups by now.
As a sort of broadcasting professional here, I was going to go, speaking of top three coaches, let's talk about Joel Quenneville. But
Well,
let's put a pin in that for a second. I'll do it in a couple minutes here. Is there any other, I know, like, listen, Tortorella is such a sexy subject. And when you're talking about coaches, it obviously like very divisive opinions and very polarizing topic. And I thought he came across pretty well in your book. Like spending that time with him, obviously you'd sort of interacted with him in the past and covering various games and various playoff series, but spending that sort of one-on-one time with him for an extended period, did that change your outlook on him as a coach and what he's kind of capable of or what he's preaching, or is there still reason for skepticism there?
It changed. Yeah, like I told him flat out, there's a point where I'm like, man, I didn't necessarily like the hire in Columbus. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought it was the classic case of you know, a team swinging the pendulum the other way, because Todd Richards was, you know, more of a player's coach. And so I'm like, all of a sudden, you go and bring in John Tortorella. Like, I thought it was an overreaction. And that was, you know, I told him that. But what this experience, I'd only dealt with John in very, the press conferences and just kind of the situations where you don't really get to know a person and their style, because you're getting them 5 minutes after a loss where they're still angry and they're cutting it short. This was an opportunity to kind of dive in. You know, we got into a lot of his use of conflict and kind of team building and having success and basically almost creating conflict at time when it may not even exist, just to get some stuff out in the open that he feels has to get out in the open in the team. And one of the lines he says he told me, and I paraphrased, is, you know, if you have something building on Monday and you don't address it on Monday, you know, you're going to have another issue on Tuesday. So now you've got two issues. And so he's just like, let's always get stuff out in the open. Let's have it out as a team. Let's MF each other if we have to. He's going to initiate it at all times. And where that becomes interesting to me, and he wants that engagement from his players. It was interesting to talk to other players who, like Ruslan Fedotenko in Tampa Bay, you know, he's like, I come from a country where you don't argue with authority, right? And now John Tortorella is MFing him or whatever, and he wants him to do it back to him. And he's like, I never would. He's like, I'm just smiling, and I'm like, I'm not going to let this guy get to me. And like, I kind of came to the conclusion, man, I don't know if I could play, how well I would do on a John Tortorella team if I was a player. I probably would get shipped out because I would be like, oh, this guy's yelling at me. I would probably like ball up into the fetal position and I'm out, right? Like, I don't think I'd put in, but he wants guys that are pushing back, and ultimately those things kind of get settled, and all of a sudden you have this team that has this identity that's like, I think Columbus is way mentally tougher now than a couple years ago, right? But then pre-John Tortorella, and I don't know how to measure that, and I don't know what that looks like. I just know, like, the Blue Jackets have a different vibe about them and a confidence, and I think that comes with having people that deal with this stuff.
Yes. Yeah. No, I completely agree with that. Okay. Speaking of top three coaches in the league, let's talk about Joel Quenneville.
Were we though? I don't think we were.
No,
we
weren't.
Guess you could say. I don't know.
No, we were talking about Mike Sullivan. So yeah, obviously I love the anecdotes about Quenneville sort of being a player's coach and looking out for them and from a financial perspective as well. And the stuff with the performance bonuses and all that. And I won't really rehash the details here because I recommend everyone just reads it for themselves, but it's really, really, really cool behind the scenes stuff. But the thing that stuck out for me for Quenneville, was twofold. One was obviously, him not really getting the credit he deserves for his work, and it sort of being perfectly cool with him because that's actually the way he prefers it. Yeah. And the second thing was, you know, there were these quotes in there about, how he makes a point of never really running down his own players in the media and calling them out publicly. And sort of, even if he's not happy with the player's performance, he'll, like, people that know him will know that he's not happy with that guy, right? But he won't actually make it too obvious to the public. But the thing is that I find interesting about that is, you know, one of the kind of, I don't know how much of a secret it is and how much of it is sort of well known by now, but it seems like one of the things that's going on behind the scenes right now is that there might be a bit of sort of bubbling turmoil between him and Stan Bowman right now. And obviously, I mean, they've been working together for so long that that's going to happen naturally. And it's amazing that it hasn't happened even more so to this point yet. But it's just, so I'm kind of curious about that dynamic there, because he's obviously been there for so long and he has this one way of dealing with the players, and you never hear him talk about them really to the media. But then he's been dropping these nuggets lately, you know, after the John Merson trade. And then even when they played the Leafs a week or so ago when they were in Toronto, he sort of made this kind of backhanded comment about how, you know, oh, it must be great to have all that young talent on your team and stuff like that, sort of, I guess, kind of taking a shot at his own team a bit, I guess. Like, I don't know. It was thinly veiled, so I'm kind of curious about what's going right on there right now with Joel.
Well, because we're trained to try to interpret him, right?
Yes, yeah.
So, like, when we're like, okay, this guy doesn't call anyone out, so if he says Marcus Kruger was, he was just okay, you know, then you're like, oh, my gosh, he just crushed him, right? So then when he says, "Yeah, it must be nice," you're like, "What is that?" You know, you're almost like you're forced to try to do some Joel Quenneville interpretation.
Right.
But yeah, so and I mean that's just his demeanor, and so like I was not optimistic he would be a part of this for kind of that a lot of those reasons. Like, this isn't a guy that wants to talk about himself. This is a book that's very, you know, this is about coaches and about their paths, and he ended up being unbelievable and it was great, but there was definitely a different flavor because it tended to be about the players more, right? And he's, you know, cheering them on, and basically it became how does he maximize these, not only the great players, the Kane and the Taves, how does, you know, he has this reputation as a guy that players will run through a brick wall for. And I really was trying to get at the why, like, how does he do that as a coach other than just being, you know, and like, I thought there was a couple, like, you know, the player bonuses stories, I thought was kind of a good anecdote of saying, okay, here's, you know, a simple thing he used to do when that was a thing that got players behind him. And again, I'll save it for the book, 'cause there's some great stories. Mm-hmm. And the other stuff to me that was interesting that really captured why players like him was the Adam Burrish stuff. And here you have a guy who's at the end of his roster, you know, as they're making the Stanley Cup run, who, if Joel Quenneville doesn't get involved, maybe feels like he's not a big part of this championship. Instead, Joel has him doing scouting reports through, you know, funny videos and playing, you know, guitar and doing Tom Petty covers, only he's doing actual scouting reports of the opposing team and really doing a good job of it. And we can talk to people like Adam would reach out to players around the league and say, okay, tell me everything about the Predators and this team. And then he would work it into a Tom Petty song. And so by the end of it, Adam Burrish can raise that cup, and Joel Quenneville, and maybe it's intentional or not, but Joel Quenneville has found this way to get a guy playing 6 minutes a night or whatever, to feel like he was a huge part of that. I just think that's cool.
There's a cynical side of me that makes me think that those videos that Adam Burrish recorded haven't been deleted yet. There must be some copy out there, and we need to put together our firepower and our brains to uncover them, because I feel like they'd be pretty funny. There's no way all copies are deleted.
Do I say that they're deleted? I'm trying to think of what.
Yeah, you did. You said
instructed to delete them.
Yes. Yeah. So there's no way he did, though.
I'm just speculating at this point. There has to be a copy somewhere. They wouldn't, but like, you know, it wouldn't be great for public consumption.
No, they're probably not the most politically correct videos, I'd imagine. All right. We're here at the full 60 already. So let's hammer through these final couple chapters before people freak out. Ken Hitchcock and Claude Julien. What stuck out to you with those two guys? Is there any key takeaways or key anecdotes that you want to share?
Yeah. I'll do it quickly. With Ken Hitchcock, to me, the most interesting thing was, here was this guy that like had this, you know, kind of a rough upbringing, was lost at sea a bit as a teenager, and basically had a couple of mentors who he credits for setting him on a path to success. And, you know, he says when he talks to his friends back home, like, he's a big golfer. He has this group that he would, you know, was on a golf team with as a kid. And like, he's like, their biggest shock isn't that I won a Stanley Cup or I'm an NHL coach. It's that I'm alive at all. Mm-hmm. And, to me, what I tried to, again, I was, you know, there was an effort to say, like, maybe there's something we can apply. And with Ken Hitchcock, it was, you know, it was the value of having people in your life who know better than you, who can guide you, who are maybe a little bit older. And I certainly have had them in my career along the way, who can put you in the right direction. And his success, especially early on in his career, I think is directly attributed to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I don't know how much of this is actually true and how much of it is just, you know, stuff you'll hear, but
yeah,
it seems like he's made a pretty concerted effort to change his coaching style and maybe lighten up a little bit. I mean, obviously, early in his career, he had this reputation for really just driving his players crazy and being way too much of a hard ass. And then after Columbus, I feel like when he went to St. Louis and now in Dallas, maybe he's never going to be a player's coach. I mean, obviously a person's never really going to change that dramatically, especially at this age, but you know, you can kind of tone it down a little bit, as we're seeing as Tortorella made a point of. And that's obviously huge, because I've made this point on the podcast a number of times, but whenever you talk to a player who might have played for Hitchcock in the 90s and you bring up his name, like, you just see them like kind of like tense up all of a sudden, and it's like there's some trauma there involved for sure. So
I think even before that, like, I think it was worse even before that. Mm-hmm. There's like a line in the story where one of his mentors says to him, "Ken, like, these are people. Like, these aren't just, you know, pawns in a hockey chess match. And so when you embarrass a guy and you chew him out and all this, like, they have souls. Like, you're damaging them." And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure if we talked to former players, especially as he got early on, like, they'd be like, "This guy's not a good guy at all, right? Like, we shouldn't be celebrating him." Like, he was hard on him, and I think there was some things he had to learn about that. But yeah, I think the Ken Hitchcock we see now is completely different. You have a guy now who knows his limitations. Like, he knows, he knows maybe there's times he needs to walk away and give the team some breathing room.
Yeah, I like that part where Bob Gainey basically told him, like, "You need to just leave for 2 days."
Yeah, just go. He's like, "No, I'll sit in the stands." He's like, "Oh, no. Let me be clear here.
Get out of here, Ken." last one, Claude Julien. I don't know, like, is there any reason why, because I think the world of this guy as a coach and his track record speaks for itself, which is makes it all the more puzzling that he's had the career he has, where teams have just kind of, you know, abruptly given up on him during the season. And I'm not even speaking about the players. I mean, in terms of, like, just getting fired by the management. So, like, why is that happening? Why is there this disconnect between sort of the results on the ice and the way he's been treated, or the way his tenures have ended in different cities?
It's a great question. And it seemed like even in the successful Boston Bruins years, they were always looking for an excuse to get rid of him. Right. And we got into that a little bit. Like, you think about the year they win a cup, you know, if they don't beat Montreal, I think it was the first round of that year, and I may be getting years mixed up, but if they don't beat Montreal, he's probably fired. And we talk about how close, like, careers and narratives and reputations can change. It's, you know, it's an overtime goal that could have done it. And yeah, there always seems to be people looking for a reason to run Claude Julien out, when all he's, you know, all he's done is had pretty good success, you know, wherever he's been, kind of right now, notwithstanding. And I'm not sure I'm pinning it on the coach in Montreal. And so, you know, that was a fun chapter for me, because that's my favorite series I've ever covered. Like, the gold medal game is my favorite game. The Canucks Bruins series, I just loved it. And maybe it was because it was kind of at a point where it was all still a little bit new to me at a national level. But there was so many characters and so many moments. There was so much to write about, and we're flying back and forth, and we're all exhausted and loopy and staying out late. And you know, you had players getting bit and tires not being pumped and whatever. Like, every single day there was something crazy to write about. And it was fun for me to then, you know, talk to Claude Julien, and as I did for all these coaches, then circle back and talk to the players involved. And what really jumps out to me was talking to the guys that were on the Canucks in that series, and most notably Ryan Kessler and Kevin Bieksa, and how much they still, like, that's still an open wound. Like, it was, if you have the audio, like, if you listen to the audio of my interview with Ryan Kessler for the book, it's like, it's hard to listen to, because he's still upset, and he's like, "I can't." And I think it was Kevin Bieksa. One of them said they just recently, you know, went back and watched some clips for the first time of that series, and, like, it still hurts, and because that's how they were so close. And again, we're looking at Mike Gillis differently, though. We're looking at Alain Vigneault differently, and Kessler, and all these guys. If you know, maybe you start Corey Schneider in Boston, or whatever the difference would have been.
Well, the disappointing thing above all else, I feel like, is, you know, we place so much of an emphasis on winning the Stanley Cup. Well, obviously, with good reason. I mean, that is the end goal every season. But it's like, you know, if you don't have a Stanley Cup ring, you're considered to be just an inferior player. And if the Canucks had won that series, you know, obviously, I feel like the Sedins, first and foremost, would get much more respect. I mean, I'm sure there'd be the detractors just because of the way they play and sort of how they go against the expectations of what a all-time great hockey player looks like. It's just because they're not really, you know, willing to be super physical or fight or what have you. But, you know, if they had that Stanley Cup ring, all of a sudden, like, they're just in a different stratosphere as superstars. For sure. in terms of consideration. And that team as a whole, I feel like, is going to kind of, I don't know how it's going to be remembered. I mean, it's already been, I guess, 7 years now. And, you know, people will remember that it was a really good team and they were the best team that season. But it was like, there's an argument to be made, it was an all-time great team. And I say that just as someone who followed it closely because of they had that sort of extra gear that you very rarely see at the NHL level where, you know, you had that little passage there about how Kevin Bieksa said, oh, let's go win 20 straight games. And then they won like,
yeah, let's just go win 20 straight games
or something. But they had this, they had this knack for like, they would really go up 2-1 or something early in the game. And then all of a sudden, like, just like that, they'd be up like 5-1.
Right.
And you'd just be like, what the hell just happened there? And, you know, they had this just insane power play and they were really firing on all cylinders. That was a peak of the Sedins, but also Kessler being able to carry his own line. I believe he had like 40 goals that season. And so they just had everything going for them. And then obviously, you know, the attrition of the playoffs kind of took hold and they lost some guys. And there's no excuses. I mean, the Bruins played remarkably well and Tim Thomas was easily the best player in that series. But it's funny how that one game, circling back, this is a good bow on this discussion because of what you mentioned at the start of the podcast, but that one game, just a few bounces here or there, would change how we look and feel about players and a team so dramatically.
For sure. Like, Mike Gillis can't get a job, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, that was, you know, that was a great team. And like, and they were hated too. Like, that was the other thing that stood out to me was, was the Bruins guys and Claude Julien specifically in our conversation saying, once we got to that series, he was getting calls from other coaches on how to stop the Canucks. Cause people didn't want to see the Canucks win cause they thought they were dirty and they didn't play the game the right way. And you know, some of the players talked about the same thing. Like, you know, they were getting calls from rivals saying, okay, and there was a good example of that Claude Julien brings up. I'm like, okay, what's one tip you got? And I think it was the Sedins, like during every TV timeout would work the refs, you know, to try to get a call after. He's like, so make sure you have somebody out there with them. And like, it was to see, not only was that team great, and they had swagger and probably some arrogance, but they were hated and disliked. And like, you ask how history is going to remember that team. I think we're going to just forget them. Right. Yeah. Like, I already started, like, when you're like, hey, what are the great teams of the last 10 years? No one's saying, oh, those Sedin Canucks teams. And they were great. They were a great team.
Yeah, they were. Were there any coaches that you wanted to include in this book, but you didn't just because you kind of had to cut it off at some point or it couldn't really work out? Like, did you give any thought to having a guy like Daryl Sutter, for example, in here?
I did. So Daryl, he was in, seemed excited about it. And then the challenge with this book was I had a very small window, about a 2-month window in the summer to do most of these interviews because I'm asking for a lot of their time, and to kind of relive some glory years. And guys in the middle of the season typically aren't going to be like, hey, yeah, let me give you 6 hours, right? So it had to be, and I'm covering the league full time, so I'm not available because I was, you know, when I was at ESPN until free agency's up. So we basically had, and the World Cup was this year, so there was a lot of these things to work that worked against us. So I basically had this maybe month and a half, 2-month window to do a majority of these, and Daryl was into it. You know, we communicated, and it just like we kind of went back and forth in email, then he disappeared, and it just. I kind of had to pull the shoot and which is unfortunate because I was looking forward to that one, because there's a little bit of intimidation from my, you know, he's one of those guys that is like in the normal press settings, difficult to deal with if he doesn't like the question. And I was looking forward to getting him in this setting because I think he's so smart. And I think he's smarter than people want to give him credit for because he kind of plays it off and whatever. And yeah, I was definitely disappointed we weren't able to get him in there.
Yeah, he gives all this kind of like crusty old man vibe.
But right, crusty, right.
You read some of these quotes from him and you're like, wow, that was very thought-provoking and interesting. Did you give any thought to sitting in a barbershop and getting your hair done with Jack Capuano? I know he hasn't necessarily
that's the
won.
Second book. It's behind the barbershop pole.
I guess obviously he hasn't won a Stanley Cup either, but a guy like Barry Trotz would have been interesting as well. But I think you kind of got the big names that I wanted to hear from in this book.
The one was John Cooper, who was the other one really wanted to like shoehorn in for a lot of reasons. I'm definitely most curious about kind of these self-made guys, and maybe that's why I like the Bob Hartley story so much. And John and I had conversations, and basically it would have been like, hey, here's a gold medal game and here's a Stanley Cup winning game. And my pitch to John was like, he had one of the all-time greats AHL runs. Like they won 6 million games in a row, a Calder Cup. This was like the Palat, Tyler Johnson crew, and that's now had success. I'm like, let's dive into that. And, you know, and I don't like, I think it would have been like, you know, nobody wants to get pinned as the AHL guy in the midst of all these Stanley Cup winners. Right. So like it was like, if the Lightning had won a Stanley Cup in this window, I think John Cooper would have been in there. And he was, you know, we talked about him doing the four, like there was, I really wanted him in there and it just didn't work out. And so that saves us something for down the line. I don't know.
Yeah. Cool. Looking forward to it. I'll give you the full 60 seconds here to plug some stuff. Where can people get this book? And tell me about what you're writing about and your podcast.
Yeah. So the book is anywhere, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. I think I make less money if you buy it on Amazon, I'm learning. So whatever you want to do.
Can people just send you money directly?
What's that?
Can people just send you money directly?
Just send me checks and I'll mail to you. Actually, I got people that want personalized books, so that's on my list of things to do also. Oh, cool. So wherever you get a book, and honestly, if you go to the library and check it out, I just want people to read it because I think there's a lot of good stuff in there, and I want these coaches, like, they gave me a lot of time and access, and I want it to be worth it. Going to the plug list, if you subscribe to The Athletic if you're not already, the stuff that we're doing on the hockey side especially is I couldn't be more proud of to be a part of this group. Every single day, there's stories that I'm like, I can't believe we're doing this. So please consider subscribing to The Athletic and do it through the Detroit story, so I get credit in my yearly bonus. Yes. And the full 60, the podcast. If you're into podcasts, which if you're listening to this still an hour and a half later, I'm going to assume you are. It's been a lot of fun and it's a little bit different. We're less topical, it's turning out, in terms of what's happening in the game right now, and more like storytelling or introspective. And I think that's just because I like that stuff. And it's, you know, you can actually go back and listen to the Mike Russo or the Ray Ferraro, you know, Frank Provenzano. They all, like, these aren't episodes that a week later they're out of date. Like, go back and listen to them. Check it out. It's called The Full 60, and it's on wherever you get podcasts.
Well, this has been The Full 75 with Dmitry Filipovich. Craig, man, thanks for taking the time. That was a lot of fun. Great job on the book, and we will chat soon, definitely.
Thanks, Dmitry.
The Hockey PDO Cast with Dmitry Filipovich. Follow on Twitter at Dim Filipovich and on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/hockeypdocast.